Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, it is Boomer the Babe Show. It is coming to you live from our studios in Youngtown, Arizona. Part of the Valley View Community Food Bank Complex and Feeding Arizona Complex. Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. If anybody's looking for a 501c3 company to a corporation to give their nonprofit dollars to, you can certainly go far worse than doing something with the Valley View Community Food Bank, where, as I said, the food is always free. Never is there a charge for an emergency food box, and the food boxes are designed specifically for the needs of the particular family that might be needing some food. So look them up at valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com, if you will, valleyviewcommunityfoodbank.com. Get hold of Jesse Ramirez, executive director and founder of the food bank, and he can help you make your decisions on the best way for you to donate and be of service to this great food bank in Phoenix, Arizona area. We have an interesting show today. Two gentlemen with us, both medical men, Dr. Bertram Pitt and Dr. Peter, I'm going to try to say this right, Mundendam, I think I got it right, and they're specializing in heart failures, issues of the heart, let's put it that way, and we're not talking about romance. We're talking about very serious and severe things that can happen to your heart, and try to do various lifestyles and so on to avoid them and test to see if you're having a particular types of problems. So it's going to be a very interesting show with these two gentlemen. I am Pete Peters. Deborah Brown is not with me today again. She's still on special assignment, as they say in the big-time news biz. In other words, she's out trying to make us some extra money with a couple of projects that she's working on. That's pretty much the way it is in the big-time news biz, too, I think. We do much more than just this radio show. Boomer the Babe Incorporated produces this show, of course, but we also do mini-books and e-books. Our e-book authors have their own shows here on the Boomer the Babe Network, and we invite you to listen to them as well. We produce videos for your website, promotional products for your business, and consult with small businesses. We are truly a multifaceted multimedia marketing company, and our latest addition to our family of products is our Boomer Speaks magazine called the Boomers. The authors in there are also the authors of our ebooks, and they're having their shows with us as well. Many of our guests also write for us in Experience Speaks. Let's get right to our guests here. I've spent enough time yakking, so first of all, Dr. Bertram Pitt is a medical doctor. He's an MD. He works via the University of Michigan Medical School, and he's been there for quite some time. He's professor of medicine emeritus in the Division of Cardiology for the University of Michigan School of Medicine in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Prior to this role, he was director of the Division of Cardiology at the University of Michigan School of Medicine. Dr. Pitt conducted research in many areas of cardiovascular disease with special emphasis on heart failure and ischemic heart disease. Our other guest is Peter Mundendam, MD. He is the Executive Vice President, Chief Medical Officer of BG Medicine. He is a pharmaceutical and healthcare executive, biopharmaceutical and healthcare executive, with an in-depth business experience ranging from early stage ventures to multinational corporations. Prior to his role, Dr. Mundendam served as President and CEO of BG Medicine from November of 2004 to January of 2012, and he is our other medical guest. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to the Boomer the Babe Show. We're glad to have you here.
Well, thank you very much.
Why don't we start with each of you giving us about 60 seconds or so of your background, other than your medical background. Where do you hail from, as they say? Where did you study? What was it that directed you into the field of medicine? Whichever one of you would like to go first, please just go right ahead.
Peter, why don't you go ahead first, and I'll follow.
My pleasure, and I want to thank you, Peter, for giving us the opportunity today. Very quickly, I'm a physician by training, indeed. I'm from the Netherlands. I've been in the United States for over 25 years now. Come from a full medical family and wanted to be in medicine, but wanted to do something beyond treating patients. I want to try to do things that survived me, and I think the work that we've done in cardiovascular disease hopefully will bring sort of a long-lasting benefit to patients with cardiovascular disease. We're going to talk more about that. I've worked for the pharmaceutical industry in the early days of my career, developed drugs along a broad range of medical conditions, great experience in both Europe as well as in the U.S., and I've been involved with diagnostic discovery and development for the past 7 years now, thinking that major advances need to come from sort of better matching patients and treatments and looking for smaller groups of patients among the larger people with a condition who need particular things that they can benefit from that might not be a benefit to the group at large. With that, let me hand it off to Dr. Pitt.
Well, my story is a little different. I'm from the United States and grew up around the New York area and went to Cornell as an undergraduate and was going to go to law school, but in fact, I was enrolled at Harvard Law School, but my parents never thought I would be a very good lawyer. Maybe I was too quiet, and I was convinced to go to medical school. I went to medical school in Switzerland and did all my training there and then came back and worked in the United States, and I spent 10 years on the faculty at Johns Hopkins before coming to the University of Michigan in 1977, where I directed the division for several years and then have been professor emeritus. And over the last, I would say, decade or two, I've been particularly interested in heart failure and have been fortunate to take part in many of the large trials of drugs that have shown a benefit in heart failure. And the story we're going to be telling today is part of that evolving story of success and trying to stop the progression of heart failure.
Well, I'm anxious to get into this discussion. I've got a whole hassle of questions to ask. Some of them are very basic, and I'll just kind of start throwing them out here, one after another, and you can take as much time to answer them as you like. We've got as much time on the show as we need to or want to take. So let's start with the general question of, what is heart disease?
Well, heart disease is a very broad term, and I think many people, when they think of heart disease, think of hardening of the arteries, atherosclerosis, and a heart attack. That's only one form of heart disease. There are many different forms. It can involve the vessels, or it can involve the pump itself, the heart muscle. And heart failure is when that pump fails to be able to deliver the nutrients and the blood to the vital organs in an efficient way. And there are several forms of heart failure. We mentioned atherosclerosis, the hardening of the arteries that a lot of people take a statin for and the cholesterol. And that can cause a heart attack when the vessels clog up and there is an accumulation of cholesterol and then there's a clot. And if you think of the heart as a motor, let's say an 8-cylinder car, and make believe there's a fuel line to each of those cylinders, of those 8 cylinders, well, there may be buildup of junk or gunk in the fuel line, and 2 or 3, 4 of the cylinders stop working because there's no gasoline. And you might be able to get by on the road at level ground, going 20, 30 miles an hour. But when you want to go uphill, that motor just doesn't have the power to do it, and you can't get up that hill. And that's one form of heart failure, and that's commonly called systolic heart failure, where there's a defect in the ability of that heart to pump. It's lost some of the cylinder. It's lost some of the muscle. But there's another form of heart failure where the eight cylinders, so to speak, are intact. But there we need a different model to think about. We need a model, sort of a bellows, that distributes the blood throughout the body to the vital organs, the brain, the kidneys, the lungs, et cetera, and the muscles. And that bellows expands as fluid goes into it and then contracts, and the fluid is pushed out. But if for some reason that bellows becomes stiffened, it can't fill, it can't expand, and so blood can't get in, and then blood can't get out, and some of that blood or fluid then backs up into the lungs and into the tissues, and once again, the heart has difficulty in distributing the blood and oxygen and the vital nutrients to the organs that are important, the brain, the lungs, the muscles, et cetera, and the kidneys. So there are two forms of heart failure. One is called systolic heart failure, and the other is called diastolic heart failure, or heart failure and preserved systolic function. And that form of heart failure is unfortunately increasing quite rapidly because it's often associated with aging, a history of high blood pressure, diabetes, and obesity. And because of the aging of our population, the increase in the epidemic of obesity and diabetes, that form of heart failure is increasing and projected to increase even more dramatically over the next decade or so. The first form of heart failure we talked about, when you have a heart attack and lose muscle, we have had successes over the years with various drugs, so-called angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blocking agents, beta adrenergic blocking agents, and aldosterone blocking agents. And we've done a very good job in reducing mortality and recurrent hospitalizations for heart failure. There's still a long way to go, but we've made, I think, pretty dramatic advances. But in that second form of heart failure, where the heart sort of gets stiffer, that bellows I told you about, we haven't, unfortunately, had any great successes. I'm involved in a large-scale trial sponsored by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, where we just completed randomization of 3,445 patients on January 31st to an aldosterone blocker, which is a drug that blocks one of the hormones in the blood, aldosterone. And we think that will be beneficial, but we won't have the answers until next January 31st. So at the moment, we have a lot of drugs that we use, but none has been really shown to decrease mortality in this form of heart failure. And so we have a long way to go. I hope that sort of gives you a little background, Pete, but maybe if you want to ask some more, or Peter Muntendam wants to chime in, please.
Anything to add, Peter?
No, I think that is obviously a great summary. I think what I can add is sort of a little bit of the statistics. I think what most people don't appreciate is how important heart failure is. Heart failure affects about 6 million people in the United States alone, about 600,000 new cases each year. And it is, in terms of years of life lost, more important than all common cancers combined. The same is true for filling hospital beds. It fills more hospital beds than most common cancers combined. So it's an incredibly important condition. And as you'll see very often in medicine, you have sort of this discrepancy between what is likely to affect us personally and where most of the attention is of the scientific community, of the lay community. You can probably find 10 or 100 or 1,000 times more things about breast cancer or prostate cancer, et cetera, than you find about heart failure. But heart failure is a more important cause of death or loss of life than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined, for example.
Let me just add this, that when we talk about that systolic form of heart failure, the type that's often associated with a heart attack or a virus, mostly a heart attack, that form is sort of most common in men, middle-aged men. But we talk about the second form of heart failure, the one where I use that bellows analogy and stiffening of the heart. in the elderly, that form is most common in women, and we're talking about ages 75, 80. So as we get older and the population gets older and women live longer, it becomes a much more important disease of women, and as Peter was mentioning, probably kills far more women than breast cancer by multiples.
There's a myriad of medications having to do with heart issues. I don't know that much about them, other than the fact that I take a couple. But what is an ACE inhibitor and what is a beta blocker? And what do they do?
Yeah, so there are hormones in the blood that are there for various reasons. They do a lot of good, but sometimes they sort of become dysfunctional and can cause some harm. So originally something like angiotensin are there to control the blood pressure and keep you from falling down, and aldosterone, if you were to lose fluid, it can retain sodium. So these have purposes, but once you have a chronic disease like high blood pressure or obesity and diabetes, some of these hormones become the bad players. And the angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors block the formation of angiotensin II, whereas the angiotensin receptor blockers block the receptor on which angiotensin works. And angiotensin has a very important role in hypertension, on constriction of the blood pressure, blood vessels, as well as on heart muscle function and growth and inflammation. And by using the so-called ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers, we've shown over the years that we can help high blood pressure and help people after a heart attack and help people with heart failure. And the same thing with the beta adrenergic blockers. They block catecholamines, epinephrine and norepinephrine, that are often useful, but sometimes when you have damage, can cause more damage. And the same thing with aldosterone. There are aldosterone blockers. So these are naturally occurring hormones that we have sort of antidotes to. We either block the formation of these hormones or we block their receptors, and that has been shown to be extremely useful in at least systolic heart failure, hypertension, and other vascular diseases.
What is, I've not heard you mention congestive heart failure. What is congestive heart failure?
So when that pump doesn't distribute the blood, sometimes the fluid builds back into the lung and pours out into the lung and in the tissues in the legs, and that's congestion. So you have a swelling of or outpouring of fluid into the lungs, hard to breathe, hard to walk up a hill, hard to lie down flat, and often in the extreme cases, the legs can swell. You can put your finger on your shin and it leaves a dent because there's fluid there, and that's just excess fluid that we use drugs like diuretics to get rid of. We get rid of sodium because the body is, because of those hormones we mentioned, retaining too much sodium and overloading the system. And the hormone blockers we talked about and diuretics are useful to get rid of the sodium and get rid of that extra fluid, which is causing congestion in the lungs and the peripheral tissues.
Now, for a person that you hear these stories and you certainly see the advertisements on television that there is no warning, that all of a sudden the first symptom of a heart attack is that you're dead. There's something on TV that they refer to as the widowmaker, that you just survived the widowmaker and you should be taking, you know, not take your aspirin or whatever they say. What other symptoms are there? I mean, I know there's shortness of breath, some swellings, and so on and so forth that you just mentioned. But beyond that, is there anything, any way of knowing? I mean, because once you've gotten to that point, you're pretty serious, aren't you?
Yeah. So, well, you mentioned the heart attack, and of course, that causes a loss of muscle, but we mentioned there are other forms that of disease that lead to heart failure. And heart failure, often you have difficulty in breathing when you're lying flat. You have difficulty in doing exercise. You might have been able to go on a treadmill and go a certain distance over 6 minutes. But now, over time, you notice that same amount of work, you get a little more short of breath and can't do it. Or you were going to walk down the block to the post office or the store, and you could do that in 10 minutes. And now it takes you 15 minutes to do it, you're a little short of breath. Or you notice you're just more tired. Of course, being tired could be due to many different things, not just heart failure. Or you notice your legs are swelling. So these are some of the symptoms that are associated with heart failure. And, of course, a heart attack could lead to sudden onset of heart failure. But other things like high blood pressure, diabetes, and obesity can be very, very gradual. And these things, you may have had high blood pressure or diabetes or obesity for a long time, but it's only when you get older that the toll begins to show and you begin to get a very, very stiff heart, and that heart can't function and you get those symptoms.
Well, that's what I think was my point, is that it can be rather sinister. I mean, it can just kind of creep up on you, and all of a sudden, boom, there it is. It's as if it happened yesterday, but really it's been happening over a long period of time.
Right. So it takes years sometimes if you've had high blood pressure or diabetes and it's not been properly controlled. If it is properly controlled, hopefully you can avoid heart failure, and that's why it's important to have regular checks by your doctor to make sure your blood pressure is okay, especially when you get to be older, over 50 or 60, and make sure you don't have diabetes, and make sure you're not obese, or do your best to reverse that obesity.
Well, I'm gonna relate this to myself, and then you can, as means of background for this next couple of questions. I was starting to go to a weight loss clinic because I have a weight issue. A friend of mine is a medical doctor. He happens to be a weight loss expert as well as a few other things that he does. And he said, however, he doesn't want me to come to his clinic until I've gone to a cardiologist and had a stress test. So I went to a cardiologist, had a stress test, and some people were getting a treadmill stress test, others were getting a chemical stress test. Why the difference? What is the difference between the two other than one? I realize you're on a treadmill, but is one beneficial over the other? Does one show something that the other one doesn't?
Well, there are different forms of trying to stress test. So the oldest form was the electrocardiographic stress test, where you would exercise and we would look at the electrocardiogram to see whether there were signs of inadequate blood flow. So we talked about atherosclerosis and those narrowing of the fuel lines supplying the cylinders for heart. Well, if those fuel lines get narrowed and you're exercising, you can't get oxygen, that is reflected in the electrocardiogram, and we can see that and know that there is inadequate blood flow to one of those cylinders. We can also look at radioactive traces and see how they distribute, and they distribute in the heart in proportion to blood flow. And if one area of the heart is not getting enough flow because that vessel is narrowed, we can see a defect in the uptake of those traces. And there are other ways we can look at the heart, not the distribution of flow, but we look at the function on either an X-ray or an ultrasound. So we have several different ways of telling whether the heart is getting adequate flow and it's functioning properly. And depending upon particular circumstances, one may have a certain advantage over another, but all are very useful in seeing that the heart is functioning or not functioning and whether there's adequate flow. But in some of these forms of heart failure, the flow is perfectly adequate, but it's not the flow, but the stiffening of the heart, as we mentioned, because of fibrosis or scar tissue that occurs in the heart as a result of inflammation that causes the trouble. So the stress test, as far as flow, may be normal, but the function may not be normal. You can't pump as much fluid, blood, and oxygen to the vital organs as is needed.
I've heard of a test recently called a heart scan or a calcium score. What is that?
So the calcium score is another way of detecting atherosclerosis, and that often early on the vessels become calcified before they become so narrowed by the atherosclerotic process. So many people get a so-called CAT scan and look for calcification. And if you see it, that's a clue that you should be paying attention to your risk factors and making sure your blood pressure is okay, your weight's okay, you don't have diabetes, and et cetera.
Now, I noticed in your bio, Dr. Pitt, that you have done work with ischemic heart disease.
Ischemic heart disease is what we were talking about when the vessels get narrowed and you get to the point that some of those cylinders, in the analogy we used of the 8-cylinder car, don't function properly. So that's ischemic heart disease, and that's the things we were talking about, a heart attack. But as I mentioned, there are other forms of heart failure where the flow is relatively normal, but the heart can't function because it gets stiffer because of this fibrosis. That is a sort of very important part of inflammation, a low-grade inflammation that occurs over years and ends up with little bits of fibrous tissue or scar tissue in various parts of the muscle, so that muscle can't expand properly and pump out the blood properly. Peter, maybe you'd like to chime in as well.
I'll be happy to. So you've heard from Dr. Pitt that there are number of different forms of heart failure. However, in the minds of physicians and also the mind of the FDA, for example, there's only one form of heart failure. Drugs get approved for heart failure, and we, if you look at the advances made in medicine in other areas, breast cancer, liver disease, immune disorders, the advances have been made on the basis of a new definition, a changing definition from more sort of a physical definition of disease to a biological definition of disease. The moment we understand the mechanism that causes the disease, we suddenly have an opportunity to treat them better, identify them better, identify them earlier, treat them better. And the work that Dr. Pitt had done in heart failure, particularly the fibrotic form of heart failure, made us ask the question, can we find out what's causing this fibrotic form of heart failure, and can we then come up with a whole sort of a paradigm to treat them better? And I came across a study now about 6 years ago where an animal experiment had been conducted that showed that a protein called galectin-3 in animals induces this fibrosis in the heart, this stiffening of the heart. And we were intrigued by it and thought maybe this is the clue to this particular form of heart failure. We sort of started talking about finding the disease in heart failure, finding a consistent underlying problem that causes this fibrotic form of heart disease. And we started developing the blood test from the very beginning, eventually had the test ready to study large groups of patients, and we found that of the heart failure patients, about 30 to 50% of the patients have elevated levels of galectin-3, this protein that causes that progressive stiffening. It was higher than what we had expected. When we started, we thought it would be about 15 to 20%. And we had, at that time, submitted the test to the FDA. The FDA had not cleared the test, approved the test in 5 years, and it became the first new cardiovascular blood test in 5 years, now approved in 2010. And we've learned a tremendous amount about that protein since we started. One exciting finding is that it is indeed a culprit. It's a cause. Many of these blood tests tell you that there's something wrong, but they signal the thing that you measure isn't the actual cause. And in this case, we believe that galectin-3 is the actual cause. We've seen that some of these patients if the level is low, they respond better to certain drugs than other, than if its level is high. But the most exciting part of this whole Galectin-3 story was that Galectin-3 has a built-in on-off switch. Very unusual for proteins. Proteins usually take injectable medications, often with serious side effects, etc., to turn them off, to neutralize these bad proteins, if you like. And in case of Galectin-3, Galectin-3 had a built-in on-off switch, and we found, we started experimenting with natural compounds to see if we can turn it off. Somewhat unusual, usually the experiments with natural remedies start in sort of the alternative medical spheres, the people who experiment with the natural remedies. But in this case, it started actually with the leading cardiovascular centers, one in France and one in the Netherlands, and increasingly in the United States as well. And what we demonstrated that you indeed can turn this Galectin-3 protein off, and in doing so, you prevent some of that heart failure. And some of these natural inhibitors occur in high concentrations in certain fruits and vegetables. So this story provides a good explanation why certain fruits and vegetables are healthy. We're experimenting with that further. And so it's a sort of fascinating thing that we have found probably a good reason why fruits and vegetables are healthy and an opportunity to administer it. And the final piece of the puzzle came from collaboration with the Framingham Heart Study, and that the Framingham Heart Study has announced that the results will be presented at the end of March at the American College of Cardiology, and the title of the presentation indicates that the Galectin-3 predicts new onset heart failure. So I think we have sort of our arms around this subgroup of heart failure patients, Galectin-3 as a cause, a blood test for it, and then an opportunity to specifically sort of neutralize that protein.
So now that blood test is available in this country at this time, correct?
Yes. The blood test
since 2010?
Yep, it was cleared by the FDA in 2010. Since then, a number of laboratories have launched it, LabCorp being one of them, one of the largest laboratory providers in the world. So it means that most patients can actually get the blood test ordered by their physician, and then they know if that protein is elevated. And if so, these are people who are at increased risk for cardiovascular problems, and the certain things that they can do to reduce that risk.
I read in some of the things that I was sent that pectin is something that citrus pectin could be used to help control this protein.
Yeah, it's sort of a we all know that fruits and vegetables are healthy. Nobody doubts that. But if you ask even the best scientists in the world what makes them healthy, you very quickly don't get much of a concrete answer. And if you ask them which one is healthiest, should I be eating tomatoes or kale or oranges? And then the scientists get silent very, very quickly. And what is exciting about this story is that we have a full, what I refer to as sort of an articulation, a full definition of a pathway where we can go from the fruit to pectin, and pectin make up the structure of the fruit. It's the, for example, in case of orange juice, it's a white stuff that separates the parts of the orange, but also surrounds the orange. It's a little white thing that you peel off your orange or your grapefruit, and that contains pectins. And pectins are very complex carbohydrates. They come from the same family as your dietary sugars, but they're very, very different. So although they are carbohydrates, it has nothing to do with diabetes or regular sugars. And there are small fragments in there, small carbohydrates that bind to Galectin-3 and that inhibit Galectin-3. And one of the best studied form is indeed pectins from citrus fruits, from orange and lemon. And it's commercially available as a supplement, as modified citrus pectin. And that's the one that we have investigated, and I've actually just started a clinical trial with in the United Kingdom.
You know, let me just say, interject that we talked a lot about heart failure and the drugs we use to treat them, We know that once you have heart failure, no matter what the cause, there's some irreversible changes, increased risk of dying, and certainly of hospitalization. And we're realizing that it would be far better if we could prevent heart failure. And having a substance such as galactin-3 at least gives us the clue that we can find certain people earlier on and prevent the heart failure before the damage to the heart or the function of the heart has decreased, and that would be far preferable than waiting till heart failure occurs and then beginning to treat it with drugs. So if we could identify people early on, and not everyone is going to be at risk, but there are some, and those people have other risk factors, usually, as we talked about, high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, family history of heart disease. If we can identify those people early, then we have a possibility of preventing it. And that, I think, is where a lot of the future research and efforts will go over the next several years.
Is there anything involved in any of the studies, your experimentation, is there anything at all that has been shown to reverse the damage?
Peter, you want to...
To a large degree, our focus should really be prevention. Once damage is done, there is certainly you can slow the progression down, but true reversal to go back to a healthy, well-pumping heart by undoing the fibrosis, that stiffening, I think is not going to work. The beauty of this model, as we just described, is that you can actually measure this galactin-3 and find people before they're on their way to developing heart failure. For example, let me sort of give you a case. A 68-year-old male develops a heart attack. At that time, the galactin-3 levels are often still low. They are normal. The individual is monitored every 3 months or so. The physician monitors that level of galactin-3. And then in some patients, after 6, 7, 8, 9, 12 months, you suddenly see that level going up. And we know that that's associated with an increased risk for heart failure, for cardiovascular death. And at that time, we probably have an opportunity. We have a window to treat that individual, three levels, diet, sort of high intake of fresh fruits and vegetables. Second one is a supplement, modified citrus pectin, for example, where you take a very high concentration. And I come back to that modified citrus pectin in a minute. And then the third one would be drugs, specific drugs. There's a class of drugs that work. So to comment on the modified citrus pectin, there's a very strong literature that citrus pectin, the stuff that surrounds these oranges, is where a very considerable part of the benefit is. The interesting thing is that in the U.S. is an incredible place for consumption of orange juice. We drink a lot of orange juice in this country. But that white stuff is actually is thrown away, and it's used for cattle feed. And we feed probably the healthiest part of the orange and the citrus fruits to cattle. And although we have started to add calcium to orange juice, and we're adding all kinds of other things to orange juice that aren't natural to orange juice, but one of the things that we should consider doing is to add some of the good stuff back. We can treat that pulp, that stuff that we currently give to cows, we can treat that and get some of the healthy components back and add that back to the orange juice or add it to yogurt and all kinds of other things, so that you can get sort of a full serving of fruit and vegetable from stuff that we currently throw away.
So there probably are a lot of cows walking around that don't have heart disease.
They probably have great hearts and great vascular systems, but it's indeed true. We're feeding a tremendous amount of this very healthy material to livestock.
Just want to say that in the orange juice you can sometimes buy with and without pulp, and probably this work suggests you should always be choosing the one with the pulp.
Well, I enjoy the orange juice with the pulp more anyhow. It's certainly got more body to it.
Right.
The you mentioned that there are some pharmaceuticals that will take care of your replacement or using of this galactin 3. Is there something that can be bought over the counter, or is it strictly by prescription?
There are no over the counter drugs that an effective class of drugs that Dr. Pitt has worked on for decades and is credited for really the development and the understanding of it is called aldosterone blockers or MRAs. I'll let Dr. Pitt tell the story, but that's a class of drugs that is probably most suitable for these patients with high galactin 3, but that is not one of the friendliest classes of drugs. Is a drug that needs to be monitored very carefully. Maybe Dr. Pitt, you can comment on that class.
Dr. Pitt, before yes. you start that right. answer, please. My question really is, for instance, can you go to a health food store and get this pectin? Will that help you any?
Well,
Now, there is there's indeed a product, a modified citrus pectin is commercially available as a supplement that most people, I think, buy it online. That's one way to take it. Obviously, you're actually taking regular fruits and vegetables that in a dose that I think you can easily get to by eating sort of your seven servings of the true good fruits and vegetables. Just to comment on that, there's a nice epidemiological study that shows that individuals who have indeed a high regular fruit and vegetable intake have a 37% reduction in their heart failure incidence after correcting for everything else. So this notion that there's something sort of very, very healthy in the fruits and vegetables that prevent heart failure is actually strongly supported by literature. So you can actually get there by eating fruits and vegetables in a high dose. But if you don't want to do it, there's always the modified citrus pectin supplement. We are conducting additional research to really understand how you can best get these, what fruits and vegetables contain most of this, and we know of modified citrus pectin, but it might very well be that particular berries have it in a much higher concentration, for example. We don't know that yet.
So let me mention a few things about the drugs. We know that the so-called aldosterone blockers and the two common ones that are available in the United States are called spironolactone or eplerenone, and they're now generically available but not available over-the-counter. You need a prescription. But those drugs have been shown to block fibrosis in animals and in man and have been successful in the systolic form of heart failure. And we hope we'll be successful in the other form, but we're still awaiting the results of our large-scale trial. Those are very good drugs, but on the other hand, like every other drug, they have side effects. And in particular, they get rid of sodium, but they can retain potassium. That isn't too bad, except a lot of people have heart failure or elderly, or they've had atherosclerosis or diabetes, and they also have renal disease. And once you have chronic renal disease, kidney dysfunction, then the body has difficulty getting rid of the potassium, and these drugs can sometimes cause too much potassium that can be life-threatening. So when we give these drugs, especially to people with concomitant kidney disease, we have to very carefully screen people for that baseline renal function and potassium, and then we have to serially monitor the potassium to make sure it stays within the normal range, and if it gets out of that range, goes too high, we have to either change the dose of the drug or give other drugs that will get rid of more potassium. So these drugs are very complex, and we'd much rather, as we said, prevent the heart failure and get there early before there's renal disease and use naturally occurring fruits and vegetables where we would have a lot less worry about side effects such as potassium, because eating a few more oranges a day or grapefruits or the pectin will certainly be far better than taking any drug that we can give you.
Through your studies and your obvious discovery that these various substances that occur in nature are beneficial, or let's put it this way, I guess maybe your proof that they are beneficial. Everybody's always said it's been suspect that we should eat better. Do you ever foresee the day that heart disease and many other possible diseases can be eradicated?
Well, I think the word maybe eradicated, not necessarily like smallpox, but completely sort of dramatically down-regulated. In other words, reduce the incidence dramatically. That's already happening in things like atherosclerosis, where the use of better diet and statins, less fats, and I think it could happen in heart failure as well by use of these fruits and vegetables and targeting individuals and other risk factors. Obviously, the obesity, the hypertension, those are very important things. If we control those things, we will have done a very good job in preventing heart failure. But unfortunately, sometimes despite our drugs, obesity, diabetes, and hypertension persist. And the consequences, the fibrosis, the scarring, is detected by the galactin. We can supplement those other risk-reducing strategies with anti-galactin strategies such as the pectins.
Is it the case, or do you feel it's the case, that in the event of my granddaughters, as an example, that their parents should be paying particularly close attention to their diets now at age 6 and 3, making sure that they're getting a habit of fruits and vegetables and starting them at a very young age, and then that in turn will hopefully lead to a much longer life and a healthy life?
I think there's no doubt about that. And if you look around at our own grandchildren and others, we know that there's obesity, even in the very young, and diabetes, unfortunately, is increasing in the very young. Years ago, that was only a problem in the middle age, and now it's beginning a problem in younger people. So weight control, diet, and not just the weight control, it's what you eat, and less sugars, and less pop, and things like that, and more of these fruits and vegetables, and so consulting your pediatrician early on and talking about good nutrition, I think, is every parent's job.
Well, it's got. I know it's tough. I mean, I know that my my daughter and son-in-law are feeding their children very, very well, very as healthy as I think they possibly can without strapping them down and forcing the vegetables and fruits down their throat.
Right.
I mean, they like their fruits, they like their vegetables, and they don't get to have a bowl of M&Ms, as an example. They don't get to have sodas and so on. They will have a juice. They will have whatever. But it's something that the parents have to be able to and willing to live by themselves.
Absolutely.
Because
it's complex because there are economic consequences, too, and there are certain levels of income where people and places where people find it difficult to get fresh vegetables and fruits, unfortunately, and their economics are such that it's very difficult. So it's a very complex problem. It's for those that are well off and live near Whole Foods and places like that, you can get organic vegetables and fresh fruits, but there are other places and other parts of the country, it's very difficult.
If you were to give somebody a list of things that they absolutely should, other than the sodas and so on and the sugars and sweets that you've mentioned, are there anything of any of the food groups that you would say really you really have to cut back on and be wary of too much?
Well, Peter, you want to take that over?
Yeah, I think obviously the number one thing that people need to do is restrict their caloric intake. It doesn't, you can eat too much of anything that isn't good. So I think that's clearly known to be bad. Even if you were to eat too much of the good food, you still get very significant damage. So I think that's an important point. The other thing is that sort of a comment that I often make is that people walk away from animal proteins because they think that the animal protein is bad. And there's no doubt that animal protein is bad at a high level of intake. But what this research really shows is it is the lack of these fruits and vegetables. So people become good vegetarians after walking away from animal proteins. But what this research really shows is that you're fine to have your steak or your fish or whatever, all with moderation, as long as you get enough of the fruits and vegetables in. And then I think one third food group in particular that we've got to move away from are these high caloric processed carbohydrates, high fructose corn syrup, et cetera. It really is bad. I think we have swung from concern about fats to, which was sort of the preoccupation that society had, cholesterol and fats, to while we were very much condoning on the carbohydrates, I think now we realize that high level of high fructose corn syrup and other condensed carbohydrates are really bad. So yes, fruits and vegetables are great. As I mentioned, oddly enough, we feed some of the healthiest portions of fruits and vegetables to our cattle. And maybe if we could figure out how to get these back into the diet, that it doesn't have to be that expensive. It is not necessarily that you've got to eat all kinds of expensive fruits and vegetables. That might be cheaper things that are very nutritious that we can promote eating. The other comment I think to make is that when the focus on lipids came, people started taking their lipids serious in the age groups where they got concerned about heart disease. So people became very lipid conscious over the age of 40 and 50 even. But what we've now really learned is that the risk that you run at the age of 50 and 60 is really based on what you've done between the ages 20 and 40. So I think that shift to earlier healthy lifestyle, I think, is a very important shift. And also measuring things like cholesterol, et cetera, when you're 20 and treating it at that time is an important shift of recent years.
Well, gentlemen, I'm amazed at I think what is really right in front of our face, under our nose, or not in our mouth, unfortunately, that we can do with regard to your studies and the prevention of this heart failure that you've been referring to and that you've been studying. Are there any thoughts other than what we've just been speaking of that could make it easier for people to get these studies and so on and so forth? Are these tests all covered by insurances? What is the status of that? Do you know?
Yeah, the GLECA3 test, as I mentioned earlier, has become available last year, is covered by most insurances. It's a relatively low-cost test. For example, Medicare pays in the sort of $20 range for that test at the moment, so it really is a low-cost test. So it is widely available. People can get it done. And I think one interesting sort of aspect of that is that people often sort of question the need to becoming more healthy and eating more healthy. And I think if you get the blood test done and you find these elevated levels, then you have an extra reason, because you know that you're the one who was at higher risk. At the same time, I want to stress, and as Dr. Pitt does as well, this is a area that continues to be we continue to learn. We can learn at an incredible pace. We know so much more now than we knew several years ago about GLECA3. There's a scientific paper about every 36 hours about GLECA3 that's published in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. So we continue to learn, but it looks as if it's a very important player in heart disease.
And as far as the tests go, I think Peter mentioned the test is available, but there are advances in the way that test is being done, and we expect over the next year or so it will be automated and eventually available in doctors' offices. Right now it's mainly through the major laboratories, but There are tremendous advances in automation of this test, so it will be much more widely available in the next few years.
So it might be like a like your test for diabetes, and maybe
right.
like your INR test that I go back and have done every month.
Like getting a serum cholesterol, measuring your bad cholesterol and good cholesterol, things like that.
Very good. Very good. I'd like to ask one last question, kind of off the topic, but nonetheless something I think that you gentlemen might have some insight into, and that is, it always seems to be the case that you can find services or procedures or medication in Europe before you can find it in this country. What is the reason for that, and do you think it's good or bad?
Peter, go ahead.
I think I've just goes back a long time in my career when I worked on contraceptive products, and that question was often raised: how come all these methods are available in Europe and they're not available in the U.S.? And we did a study and actually showed that the opposite was true, that more were available in the U.S. And I think the in the supplement world, for example, where I think very significant advances have been made, there are more supplements available in general in the U.S. than Europe. U.S. laws have been much more open to these kinds of products. And on the pharmaceutical side, I think that it also has changed. I think the old days that pharmaceutical products were available first in Europe is now has largely changed. Our blood test, this galactose-3 blood test, was commercially available about the same time in Europe and the U.S., but it has the adoption has gone much quicker in the U.S. because of sort of this great infrastructure in the U.S. of laboratory service providers. So it so in this particular case, I think the U.S. is clearly not lagging behind.
Yeah, I think the regulatory agencies, both in Europe and the United States, get closer and closer together, and most things are available pretty soon one way or the other, and sometimes we're ahead, sometimes they're ahead. But I think the FDA does a pretty good job overall in making sure that when we get something, it's reasonably well studied. There have been some exceptions on both sides of the Atlantic, but in general, I think we're very fortunate to have the FDA there and making sure what we get is safe.
I don't have any way to measure that myself. I mean, that's why I asked the question of you two professionals, because I mean, it's a perception that I have, and obviously, it's nice to know that it's somewhat misplaced. So, it's nice to know that we're pretty close at any rate as far as the rapidity at which we can have something come to market that's going to be having a mass benefit. So that's good to know. Well, gentlemen, I tell you, it's been a very interesting time talking with you. We did take an hour. I know we were talking about that before we went on the air, but we did take an hour. If anybody needs to or wants to find out more about your studies, your work, is there a way that they can get hold of you? Would it be beneficial to get hold of you? Should they consult their own cardiologist? What do you recommend?
Well, I think they should
consult
their own cardiologist, but Peter, you could provide some information where people can find out more about galactin-3.
Yeah, the a great source is a website that we have up and running, www.galactin-3.com, galactin-3.com. And I think that's a great way, or to sort of Google it and Google galactin-3 and pectin, if that's how you're going to get a lot of great information. The beauty of the internet for this kind of information.
Very good. It's been a pleasure meeting you over the telephone and talking to you. I appreciate your putting up with my lack of knowledge of the subject and being willing to answer
my... It's been very, very enjoyable. Well, thank you very much.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Believe me, Dr. Bertram Pitt from the University of Michigan and Dr. Peter Mundendam from Chief Clinical Officer with BG Medicine. Thanks again, gentlemen, for being with us, and have a great day, great weekend, and we'll hope to see more of your great studies and more of your fine work coming out in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This has been the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio. You've been listening to these two fine doctors talking about their work with the galactin 3 protein and how it affects heart disease, and good information just generally about heart disease that was brought to light. Thanks for joining us today. As always, we try to bring you good conversation on the Boomer the Babe Show here on Blog Talk, and I think we brought you a pretty good conversation today. You can listen to Boomer the Babe Show every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk. Remember, we do much more than host this radio show. Check us out at boomerandthebabe.com. See everything that makes up the Boomer the Babe Incorporated. Don't forget to sign up for our new online magazine, Experience Speaks. You can do that at boomerthebabe.com. And until then, make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and we'll see you again later in the week for more talk and more shows with regard to all kinds of Boomer activities and Boomer information. Thank you very much. Have a great day, everybody.